You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony. Alan Chews is a book critic for NPR's All Things Considered, a writer and a novelist. His latest novel, now out in trade paperback, is To Catch the Lightning, and his newest book is a collection of travel essays titled A Trance After Breakfast. Thank you for joining me, Alan.
A pleasure, Rick.
We have an interesting mix of books to talk about today. Let's start off with William Stryon, his new collection of essays.
Yes, Styron. Well, it's fictional sketches. It's called The Suicide Run, and the subtitle is Five Tales of the Marine Corps. I mean, these are pieces, most of which appeared in magazines in the 70s and 80s. I think there's one or two that appear here for the first time in print. And some of it comes from a novel that he called The Way of the Warrior, I believe. About a Marine Corps officer who reads Balzac and Flaubert, I think. at least Flaubert. He appears as a full-fledged character in one of these sketches called Marriott the Marine, and he appears as a character in another one of the sketches, but not the major character. I mean, this is a Marine Corps officer who says things like, "Where would Faulkner be without Joyce?" Or, "Take from here to eternity." Have you read that?
Not your typical Marine, I would think.
No, but then neither was Styron. Mm-hmm. He served at the end of World War II, and he never saw combat. He was slated to go into combat in the Pacific Theater, but it was just too late. Fortunately for him, and then he was called back as a Marine Reserve officer in the Korean War, and
that's the title piece, "The Suicide Run."
Yeah, "The Suicide Run" is it's an anecdote. He and a fellow Marine drive from their base in North Carolina. They drive up to New York, meet women, and spend the night. And then they drive all the way back in time to report for duty Monday morning. That's a neat sketch, and there's some wacky Marine characters in it. But the tone mostly of these pieces is very doleful and melancholy. Let me read the opening of this of the piece called "Marriott the Marine." "In the spring of 1951, when I was called back as a Marine Reserve to serve in the Korean War, I was in my mellow mid-20s, though I felt like a beaten man. A number of years ago, I wrote a fictional narrative based loosely on this period in my life." And he's referring to Styron's "The Long March," that wonderful novella about serving in the Marine Corps Reserve. "And it's possible that those who may have read that work will, in the account that follows, discern a few familiar echoes, since I'm certain to trespass here and there upon that earlier restless mood. Basically, I'm an unaggressive, even pacific type, civilian to the marrow, and the very idea of military life sets up a doleful music in my brain. No fifes, no pipes, no gallant trumpet calls, only a slow, gray dirge of muffled drums. In my reveries of the Marine Corps, it's for some reason almost always raining." So you get that melancholy mood. The opening story is a sketch of a Marine Corps prison guard named Blankenship. This duty is kind of like serving, as a cop in one of the tunnels in and out of New York City. Just a miserable, miserable duty who loses it finally when a quarrelsome prisoner challenges his authority. Again, you get this tone of just darkness and regret and melancholy. It's almost, it's Conradian in a certain way, and you can hear that music in that in that little selection that I read. It's it ain't country music. It's elegiac and nice long sentences. You know, it reminds us of Styron's whole novels at its best.
It reminds us too that language can bring beauty to any mood and any situation, because even though the situations he's describing are alternately surreal and disturbing or just upsetting in some way, and his mood is, as you say, melancholy throughout, the language is beautiful and I think really brings the reader into this mood and into these places in a way where you can, you know, accept them and understand them.
Yeah, and that's his, I think that's his Southern heritage, that attention to the music of literary speech as well as colloquial speech.
And the mention of Faulkner is no...
Oh, yeah.
No accident either, is it?
Right. So you get this very interesting combination in these character sketches of the edges of the life of the military, and you know, a major American writer trying to sketch out experiences that he really hadn't put into a full dress work of fiction. And alas, you know, he died. So this is probably the last Styron that we're going to see, but we're definitely worth reading. Worth reading, even though, you know, the work, these are sketches, and the works that he excerpts them from are incomplete.
The power of the language is always there. He's a superbly talented writer.
We miss him. We should miss him.
We
don't miss him. Now, this guy, Brian Keightley, is a validly experimental writer. He's a New Englander. He's from Northampton, Mass. He teaches at the University of Denver. And I've read and reviewed one or two of his earlier novels. I think this is his third or fourth. Very interesting. I guess you'd call him a conceptual writer. But the concept of this book is really very, very fruitful. Don't mind mixing my metaphor there. A fruitful concept. He does a history of his hometown, Northampton, Mass., from the 11th century on through the present. And he settles on dozens of characters and has them each basically speak a monologue about themselves in relation to the place and the time in which they're living. And really beautiful. He's got you know, New England ministers, puritanical New England ministers, and Puritan lovers, teenage lovers, who are going off into the woods to get away from the puritanical rule at home. They all speak in monologues, and they all kind of open their hearts and minds, like kind of like spirits at a seance. Can I read a little here? Here's Jonathan Edwards in 1731, you know, the Puritan minister. He says, "I rise between 4 and 5 each morning, and I spend 13 hours a day on study. My usual diversion is riding horseback, and I decide before leaving home what should be the subject of my thought. I pin a piece of paper to my coat and charge my mind to associate what I have written on the paper." And then you know, around the same time, 1738, he kind of gives us this voice of a 16-year-old Christian boy talking about going off in the woods with his girlfriend. "Molly and I do not deceive out of fear of discovery or because it pleases us to, because we do no one harm, and because we enjoy accumulating venal sins." And, you know, and then he's got his gay brother in a short chapter, and he's got himself as a young boy reciting the names of the streets in Northampton.
Richard Nixon.
Fairfield, Fern, Locust, Myrtle, Maple, Elm, Audubon, Evergreen. And he's got his 83-year-old grandfather in 1985, noticing, he said, my grandson is writing a novel about me, and he enjoys asking about ancient history. So it's just a wonderful kind of palimpsest of voices, all the way from one of the earliest Indian inhabitants of the region, although that comes late in the book. Wonderful surprise. On through Kitely and his focus on his family growing up in Northampton. Northampton never seemed so beautiful, I would say.
It's beautifully orchestrated, too, the procession from one to the other, from one voice to the next, the alternation of time periods, the, mm-hmm. the moving from one mood to the next. It's rather musical, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's like a nice little symphony and superbly well-written.
And it's, you know, if you're looking for an experimental work, I mean, there's hardly one I can say recently that's more successful than this. And as you say, it's beautiful.
As you say, it's something that you don't have to be interested in experimental fiction to read.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of general fiction readers could pick this up and whip through it and go, wow, this is good.
You just have to have lived or be living in one place for a little while and find yourself attached to it for some good reason or even bad reason.
Mm-hmm.
It's all, you know, it's about, what does Milton call it? Everything has a local habitation and a name. Kitely does a wonderful work out on this concept.
And our next novel is Margaret Atwood, The Year of the Flood.
Yeah, which, I'm very disappointed with it. I have to confess I'm only halfway through because I just dread going back to read it. I'm surprised myself because I liked, this is sort of a pair with
Oryx and Craig.
With Oryx and Craig, which I enjoyed. And this, I am not enjoying at all.
Now, I have to say, when I approached Oryx and Craig, it was with a certain amount of fear, because
mm-hmm.
Literary writers who go into science fiction often just don't get it.
Yeah.
And I was pleasantly surprised by Oryx and Craig. I thought it was rather good, and I thought the science fiction aspects of it were well enough handled that I didn't go, oh my God.
Mm-hmm.
And moreover, just the writing and her layered manner of plotting, I thought made it really pretty entertaining. And it was well written. It had kind of a nice, powerful finish.
Yeah.
And now I'll tell you that The Year of the Flood, I approached it the same way. I was still a little bit hesitant,
mm-hmm.
although I had more confidence in her science fiction aspects of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I had some of the same feeling as you did when I read through it, but I felt that actually when I finished it, I felt it was a good, quite well written, and
mm-hmm.
it actually makes the first book better. The parallels and the way she tells the story as it unfolds
mm-hmm.
is really, I think, quite superb. She brings out the devices she uses in the first book, where she kind of leaves you wondering what the heck is going on
mm-hmm.
and leaves you in situations where you're not sure what everybody's motivations is, and then clears them up as she tells these different parallel stories. She uses that at the second level in this book, so that as you're reading through this book, and it takes a while, I'll grant you that. It's somewhere about three-quarters, two-thirds of the way through where she has, you know, the big reveal. And the big reveal is I thought, pretty worth it, and it allows you to put things together. But I will say that her subject is not, I think, quite as compelling in this book, because unless, of course, you've just read Karen Armstrong's The Case for God,
mm-hmm.
in which case you're thinking, wow, this is kind of like the science fiction version of The Case for God.
Because, is that right?
Oh, yes, yes. The God's Gardeners and a lot of her religious themes in here are all kind of bubbled up science fiction evocations of what Karen Armstrong talks about, which is this idea that religion has become, you know, underwent a split in the Enlightenment with the science.
I'm on page 138 or something, 178. I'm bound to finish. 181, it only seems like 138. I'm going to finish it, and we'll see, but right now I'm a minority report on this. I, there's another novel that comes to mind, and remember Marge Piercy's novel, He, She, and It?
Yes,
in
yes.
Which the characters reduce themselves to zeros and ones and play hide-and-seek in a computer. I mean, I thought that was in a program. I thought that was a wonderful book coming rather unexpectedly from a writer who mm-hmm. doesn't usually do science fiction. And my memory of it is much more enjoyable than this one. But I will keep up with it because I did like Oryx and Craig.
Yeah, I was pleasantly surprised by both of these, and you know, I talked with her, and mm-hmm. I was shocked. She's a kind of a science fiction geek.
Yeah,
which is something I didn't really expect.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So the paperback version of this that just of Oryx and Craig that just came out mm-hmm. Places this as a second book in a trilogy.
Huh.
And one thing I will say, for a second book in a trilogy, which are usually the real laggers, because mm-hmm. It's neither a beginning nor an end,
yeah.
This book handles that aspect, I think, mm-hmm. much better than you will mm-hmm. Normally find.
Well, listening to you, I'm convinced. To go on, at least.
yeah.
You know, in a Beckettian fashion, I can't go on, I'll go on.
I've been speaking with Alan Chews. His latest book, out in trade paperback, is To Catch the Lightning. He also has a new book of lovely travel essays that are completely enjoyable. And I would say that his evocation of the travel border guard work is not unlike some of William Stryon's work. It's really pretty powerful. And that's in A Trance After Breakfast. Thank you for joining me, Alan.
My pleasure, Rick.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.